Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're learning more today about the most senior member of Al-Qaeda in custody. U.S. military officials say Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is confessing not only to masterminding the 9/11 attacks, a confession he's made before, but also to personally beheading reporter Daniel Pearl and planning to assassinate former U.S. presidents and the Pope. The confession is part of a transcript released by the U.S. military of a hearing held at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center in Cuba over the weekend. Earlier today, we spoke with Carol Rosenberg, who covers the U.S. military for the Miami Herald, and asked her what jumped out at her from this new confession.
This was the most extraordinary laundry list of global international terror activities that went from one end of planet Earth to the other and span maybe 10 years. And when I spoke to one of the human rights lawyers last night, he said it looked like somebody got the list off whitehouse.gov. I mean, nobody could have stood up there and recited that from memory. And in fact, he didn't recite that. They were working from a script, which is typical down there for these proceedings. This is not a trial. It's a pre-trial proceeding, well, pre-trial proceeding, meaning everyone in the room is a military officer. He's alone. He got no attorney. He had no independent representation. And basically, all these officers were doing was trying to decide whether he would be categorized as an enemy combatant, which is absolutely a sure thing. From there, they could actually choose to charge him with a war crime under President Bush's new commissions proceedings, which would put him in front of a military tribunal. And at that point, conceivably, he'd get a lawyer.
Let's go back to that list. Allegedly, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's being called KSM, admits to 31 events, as you said, on this laundry list. The 9/11 attacks were number two on the list. So what was number one?
Oh, the World Trade Center attacks in 1993. He starts off in almost a chronological recitation of virtually everything that the Americans have blamed on Al-Qaeda for more than a decade.
Number three on the list was censored. Do we know what number three was?
No, there's no way to tell, and it's really interesting because the first two he claims to credit for actually took place. Number four, after the deletion, is the shoe bombing, which didn't take place. So it's a little bit tantalizing. Is number three something that happened that we don't know that Al-Qaeda did? Is it something that we never heard about in the first place? Is it something that maybe was plotted and the Americans managed to avert, but we never heard about it? It's very interesting, number three.
Or is it possibly something that is known and is missing from the list, which is the bombing of the embassies in Africa?
For sure it could be the embassies in Africa, but that doesn't make much sense given why would you not have included it? One of my editors said perhaps it's something he believes happened and actually didn't occur while he was in secret detention at one of these CIA black sites for the last 3 years.
Carol, for those who might think that KSM was forced to make these confessions, he says he wasn't coerced, and in fact, some are thinking it's the exact opposite, that he may be claiming credit for more than he did.
Yes, there's some people who think that this man is a bit of an egomaniac and that he sees himself as an arch-terrorist, a master terrorist. So yes, he'll claim things at places of events where he never was. But there's no way to know because we haven't seen him. And nobody, except for the military or intelligence agencies, has seen him since 2003.
I should say he has said he wasn't coerced at Gitmo. So, Carol Rosenberg, you started to say what may happen from here. What may happen from here?
Once this man is certified as an enemy combatant, which is assured based on that transcript, he then gets put into the possibility of being put before a military commission, which is a war crimes court, which was created by the Bush administration with the Republican Congress, and it's trial by military officers using a new handbook that just came out, and with the ultimate punishment of the capacity to execute him.
Yeah. And if, in fact, he was responsible for as many things as he says he was responsible for, what does that tell us about Al-Qaeda, if, in fact, this key player has been out of business for a while?
The administration told us this was the Al-Qaeda operations chief. It would be almost like chief of staff to Osama bin Laden. He would have had his fingers on every operation all over the globe. So in some ways, that list would support it. The question for anybody who's taken a look at it from the outside is there a new operations chief and is somebody else working and running the day-to-day operations for Osama bin Laden.
Or, as you've said, perhaps this isn't the guy, and he's maybe aware of things, but making up how big a role he played.
I think that the guy certainly had a hand in many of these operations. He bragged like he knew some of them. The question is whether he threw in the kitchen sink to inflate his sense of importance.
Right.
But we won't know until there's a trial and we actually see any evidence against him.
And Carol, before we let you go, what are just some of the things that were on the list that either surprised you or maybe Americans weren't aware of or hadn't remembered?
I think what struck me was the list of assassination attempts against President Carter and President Clinton. I mean, I don't know that we'd ever heard about that. And Pope John Paul II, I mean, he may have just been trying to come up with names of people who he saw as American enemies. And then there was this sort of landmarks around the world aspect to it. Big Ben, the Panama Canal, the port city of Eilat in Israel. It's like he had taken a globe and spun it and picked targets as his fingerland.
Yeah, these were the unrealized attacks, Chicago's Sears Tower, NATO headquarters, Europe, the New York Stock Exchange. He said these were all plotted but not carried out. Carol Rosenberg, correspondent for the Miami Herald, with more on the military transcript of the confession of accused 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. To read the transcript, go to our website, here-now.org. Carol, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for calling.
Again, that conversation was earlier today. This note to that mysterious censored item number 3 Carol talked about. The U.S. military just released a revised transcript of the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed hearing and confirmed to us that the previously censored item number 3 on the list was the 2002 killing of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. They say they held it back to notify the family. In the revised transcript, the suspected al-Qaeda leader is alleged to say, "I decapitated with my blessed right hand the American Jew, Daniel Pearl." He then boasts, "Look at the internet. There are pictures of me holding his head." Switching gears, the coffee giant Starbucks says it plans to open at least 40,000 more stores in the coming year, half of them outside the U.S. Starbucks is expanding at the rate of 6 shops and 350 new employees a day. Well, the sandwich maker Quiznos isn't far behind. It's one of the fastest-growing food chains. It's also coming under growing criticism from some of its franchisees. Recently, the New York Times reported the story of Bob Baber, who had 2 Quiznos stores in Southern California. Baber committed suicide in November in a Quiznos store and left behind a note blaming the chain for ruining his life. A spokesperson for Quiznos told the New York Times it was deeply saddened by Mr. Baber's death, but that it was inappropriate to comment further. Well, Baber had a legal dispute with Quiznos, and he wasn't alone. And Quiznos isn't the only chain targeted by disgruntled franchisees. It's a cautionary tale for thousands of Americans planning to make a franchise their American dream. Susan Kezios is president of the American Franchisee Association. She joins us from the studios of Chicago Public Radio. And Susan, first of all, tell us, how does the franchisor-franchisee relationship work? Who pays whom what to start?
The person who invests in the franchise, the franchisee, pays money to the franchisor, an initial upfront franchise fee, and a variety of other fees to the franchise corporation and other vendors, other suppliers like landlords.
In the case of Quiznos, it can be about a $25,000 license fee just to put in your bid to open a store.
It's a $25,000 upfront initial franchise fee. Total investment for Quiznos can be $200,000, $250,000.
Well, and what does that initial fee get the franchisee? What is Quiznos then supposed to do in return?
Well, Quiznos is supposed to help you open up a store, give you initial training, provide ongoing assistance. In its ideal state, someone who purchases a franchise doesn't know how to operate a business from scratch themselves, so they're willing to invest money, put a great deal of trust in another person in a corporation to teach them how to run a business.
Right, and in return, they don't have to do all the trouble of a startup because presumably the business plan has already been tried by a company like Quiznos, and it's been successful, and so the franchisee is buying into that. And you said Quiznos is supposed to help the franchisee open up the store, including finding store locations. And this seemed to be one of the complaints of some Quiznos franchisees, that Quiznos took the $25,000 fee and did not find them the locations.
For example, in New Jersey, it was a big deal. They started selling franchises in New Jersey in about 2001. And at the end of 2003, they sold 150 locations and 20 ended up being opened. I mean, the numbers nationally, from what the franchisees tell me, are even greater. They've sold something like 8,500 Quiznos franchises, but they've got 4,200, 4,300 open.
And they just keep the license money? Is that legal?
When you speak with the attorneys who represent franchisees who are now involved in many disputes with the corporation, the attorneys are telling me that Quiznos claims they have a right to keep that $25,000 upfront franchise fee.
Well, and another problem with Quiznos, at least according to the franchisees, is that part of the contract calls for them to purchase their materials for their stores from companies designated by Quiznos. Why do the franchisees think that's a problem?
This is one of the dirty little secrets in franchising. When you sign your franchise agreement today, and the agreements are not short-term arm's-length contracts, they are long-term, hundreds of pages, you agree for the term of your contract, be it 10 or 20 years, to at all times buy products and supplies from the franchisor or the franchisor's approved suppliers. However, there's a little bit of a loophole in these legal documents in that you also agree today to at all times be in compliance with their operating manuals, their policies, their procedures, as they may change from time to time. And what they change from time to time is the fact that they do receive kickbacks, commissions, rebates, referral fees from suppliers. The franchisees are actually paying inflated prices for their products or supplies.
Well, in fact, some say that franchisors, these companies, are actually making a lot of their money. This is how they make their money, through the relationship with these subcontractors. And at the same, in the same month that this gentleman committed suicide, 28 other Quiznos franchisees filed a class action lawsuit against Quiznos for forcing them to buy food and supplies at unfair prices. But, you know, some would say the fact that Quiznos or any company might require franchisees to buy food or supplies through designated suppliers isn't surprising, because that's how they control quality.
Controlling quality is one thing. Restraining trade on whom you may purchase your products or supplies from is a totally different thing. They absolutely have the right to define the quality of the meat, the quality of the coffee, the quality of the vitamins. But they should not be restraining trade. They're not competing fairly in the marketplace. They're making their money by squeezing their franchisees.
What about the idea that, as you said, there are documents, and they may be long and very wordy, hundreds of pages, but it's sort of a buyer beware that it's all spelled out in these contracts.
It's not all spelled out in the contracts, because you are signing what, in effect, is a moving target. You have signed a contract that says you will at all times be in compliance with the corporation's policies and procedures as they may change from time to time. The corporation absolutely changes those policies and procedures all along the way. They have the sole and unilateral right to do so. So that becomes a contract that, in effect, you have not signed.
Susan Kezios is president of the American Franchisee Association. By the way, we attempted to reach Quiznos. They haven't responded to our calls, but told the New York Times lawsuits against them are frivolous. Well, when we come back, we're going to switch to coffee, franchise owners who lost big after investing in the coffee beanery. Back after a quick break. Young, it's here and now. Back with more of the difficulties and legal issues many small business people say they're having with franchisers. We've been speaking with Susan Kezios of the American Franchisee Association. We'll hear from her again in a bit. But first, we want to bring two franchisees into the conversation. Richard Welshans and Deborah Williams are from Annapolis, Maryland. They say they sunk more than $1 million into a Michigan chain called the Coffee Beanery. And they say one of the problems, the chain didn't divulge that its cafe stores were historically unprofitable, and they're on the line now. Deborah, you're now trying to get your money back from the coffee beanery. What happened? What's your issue with the chain?
First of all, in our contract, our franchise agreement clearly states that the coffee beanery, for instance, is an approved supplier of goods and services to us, and they go on to say that they don't get better pricing than we would get if we went to the supplier ourselves. We did not know that they made huge amounts of money off of this until we went into litigation. One piece of equipment was marked up $2,000 alone.
And where was the kickback? I mean, where did the coffee beanery benefit from that? Did they make that $2,000?
Yes, they did. That is not passed on to the franchisee. Our store is one of the smaller stores, and it was over $350,000 to build that store.
Well, there are others who would seem to back up your findings, Deborah. According to Forbes, cash flow from operations for the coffee beanery has fallen 78% since 2004. They are making their money from, as you said, the sale of equipment and products to franchisees. And last September, the Maryland Attorney General's Office found the coffee beanery in violation of state franchise law for misrepresentations about its franchise offering. You could have gotten your initial licensing fee back then, Richard, did you?
We did not accept it because there was also a caveat in there that if you accepted the rescission, you would release them from any further actions.
And you want to recoup all your losses. How much would they be?
Right now, $1,700,000. Deborah and I have not drawn a penny out of the business from the standpoint of being paid in over 3 years. We have commitments, again, as far as contracts with the landlord for a 10-year lease, which were responsible for any of those years. If we were to close our store today after 3 years, we'd still be responsible for 7 years.
Not to mention the wages that you might have paid people, the operating costs. So you turned down getting your license money back. Are you going to try to go to court to get all of your losses?
We've been to arbitration.
The lawyers have put together their closing briefs and sent those to the arbitrator, and we're waiting for a decision now in March.
Well, I'm reading other stories. There's an Oliver Garner who spent $300,000 to open a cafe store in Chicago, but sold it for only $85,000. He's now $400,000 in debt.
The bank sold his store for the asset.
Mary Sue Shaganaw-Levin opened a cafe store in Ferndale, Michigan with her son. They're now $1 million in debt trying to sell the store.
And they're going to foreclose on her son's home.
So you all know each other?
Oh, we do know each other, absolutely.
Well, how is it that this chain is even still around?
One of the things I would like to say as far as how they continue to operate, mm-hmm. You have a Stephen Toporoff of the FTC, who I know of six people who have written him, including Richard and I, three or four times. You don't get a response. You get nothing from them. They turn their head the other way, and these are the very regulators that should be enforcing the laws on the books, and they are not enforcing them. And then there is the Attorney General in the state of Michigan, and the franchise agreement is governed under Michigan law. We have written to Mike Cox in his office at least three or four times, and we know six other people who have also written to the Michigan Attorney General, Mike Cox. And what they do is they send your letter of complaint to the attorneys for the coffee beanery, who then, of course, write a letter back to the Attorney General and say that their client is innocent, and then they forward the letter from the coffee beanery attorneys to whoever's complaining, in our case us, and start off with, this is the response, your file's being closed, and if you're not satisfied with the result, file a case in civil court.
But Susan Kezios of the American Franchisee Association, there are franchises that are wonderful for franchisees, aren't there?
There are a lot of franchisees who've made a lot of money in franchising. There are a lot of good franchisors. But the days of buying a McDonald's franchise and making $1 million, those days are over because of the way the contracts are written. You know, in real estate, it's location, location, location. In franchising, it's the contract, the contract, the contract. And the potential for abuse is written into each and every contract.
Absolutely.
Susan, I'm wondering if one of the reasons that more Americans don't know about this and maybe still, you know, looking to snap up franchises is that we wouldn't have heard of it except for Bob Baber, which is where we started this story, a Quiznos franchisee who committed suicide. I mean, it seemed to have taken that to make this a story that more people are aware of.
Interestingly enough, over the last couple of decades, many franchisees have committed suicide. Many franchisees die of heart attacks because of the stress of what goes on within particular franchise systems. The difference with Bob Baber is he left a suicide note specifically on his body and in his computer for the press to read. and to hear. That was the difference.
Susan Ketsios, president of the American Franchisee Association, and also weighing in there, Deborah Williams, along with Richard Welshens. They bought into the Michigan chain Coffee Beanery and are now in arbitration to try to get their money back. Thank you all for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for the record, a spokesperson for the Coffee Beanery told Here and Now that the company wouldn't comment on Deborah Williams and Richard Welshens's case. The Michigan Attorney General's office told us it's still pursuing complaints against the Coffee Beanery. And a spokesperson for the Federal Trade Commission says the FTC can't comment on any pending investigations. And as we said earlier, the food chain Quiznos didn't return our calls, but told the New York Times the company believes there is no merit to any of the cases against it. Still, it's worth noting that Quiznos recently hired a new chief executive, a turnaround specialist named Gregory Brenneman, who was quoted as saying his first goal would be to improve the profitability of the franchises. As we just heard, franchisees claim they pay too much for supplies. He seemed to agree, saying food costs were way out of line and would come in line quickly so that profits for the average owner could climb by at least $10,000 a year. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, Valerie Plame Wilson, the woman whose name launched the case against Louis Libby, testifies before Congress. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, women and sexual abuse in the military in Iraq. That's after the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. An American soldier in Iraq admits to carrying a knife, not to defend against insurgents, but to protect herself from being raped by male soldiers in her unit. That's one of the claims in a startling article in Salon.com. Sexual assault against women soldiers. The journal Psychosomatic Medicine conducted a study in 2004 in which 64% of female veterans said they were sexually abused while in the military. Helen Benedict is a journalism professor at Columbia University. She wrote the article for Salon.com. And Helen, how many female soldiers did you speak to in doing your research, and what sort of treatment did they describe?
When I wrote the article, I'd already spoken to about 20 soldiers in depth. That's gone up to 30 since the article came out, because I heard from so many of them. It was the first thing that many of them brought up was the atmosphere of sexual threat that they had to endure every day from their fellow soldiers. Several of them mentioned being assaulted. Some have told me about rapes.
Can you describe the atmosphere the soldiers described to you? I mean, what kinds of things? Can you paint the picture of what life is like for many women?
Yeah. The word they often use is climate. The climate being, as one said, it's like putting three women in a frat house. A lot of the platoons are just so male-oriented and so male-dominated that they regard women with hostility and suspicion. Some of the older soldiers have the attitude that women are really only there to service them sexually, and because there are no prostitutes available in Iraq, that's why the government is giving them female soldiers. They've said that to the soldiers I've talked to. Others do see them as sexual prey. Some see them as just padding for not important jobs. But the constant demeaning comments all the time, you know, even if it's not actual assault, it's just teasing and sexual pressure and looking at you and all, you know, in sexual ways and undressing you with their eyes and all the time, 24 hours a day, it just wears these soldiers down. And as one of them said to me, every morning I'd wake up and I'd think about having to face this, and I would get more and more worn out by it. Why can't we just be left alone to do our jobs?
Well, and we shouldn't dismiss atmosphere because, at least according to one of the anecdotes, that can be fatal. You quote a top-ranking colonel, Janice Karpinski. We remember she was demoted after her role in Abu Ghraib. She says she was scapegoated, and she told you that in 2003, three female soldiers died on a base in Iraq. They died of dehydration because, what, they were afraid to do what?
They were afraid to drink from the middle of the day on because they didn't want to have to use the latrines at night because there were rapes going on in the latrines. The soldiers would hang out near them. It was pitch black and drag women into the latrines and rape and abuse them.
Now, the military says that Karpinski is, you know, just sour grapes, but how many other stories like that did you hear?
I heard a lot. In fact, in response to that quote, I heard several soldiers wrote and said that's exactly how I felt about it. It was too frightening to go out in several of the bases, and like Camp Aravan. The commanders tell the women soldiers not to go out alone after dark, not to go to the latrines or the showers without a buddy because it's so dangerous, not because of the Iraqis, but because of the other soldiers.
How is the military reacting to these reports like yours and to complaints from women? I mean, have they responded at all?
Because the reports of rape were going up so much in 2003 and 4, the Defense Department put together a task force and do an investigation and reform the reporting procedures for women who'd been assaulted or raped. But the women I've talked to said that that's all cosmetics and it doesn't really make any difference.
What do women tell you happens to them when they report a rape?
It's terrifying to even try and do it, because if you do, you're seen as a traitor by your fellow soldiers. You're seen as betraying the camaraderie of brothers and sisters together in war. So you risk being ostracized or seen as that woman who's trying to ruin a soldier's career. So that's the first hurdle. They're often dismissed when they do report. If they find the right person to report, they're then supposed to have a counselor and an advocate sit with them while they're interviewed about what happened. But that doesn't always happen. So a lot of soldiers say they end up being alone versus the accused assailant, who will have lots of people on his side, and it'll be all of them versus her. Those are some of the things. And sometimes the reports do work, and you know they do get followed through. It's not universally bleak.
It's not as if it's all about rapes. As you said, there's atmosphere and an attitude, which you described, and with apologies, you know, for the language. Women told you that they were treated in three ways. They were only allowed to be three different kinds of women in the military. Could you explain?
Yes, one of the first soldiers I ever talked to told me this. She said, there are only three things a man let you be in the military: a bitch, a hoe, or a dyke. A bitch if you won't sleep with them, a hoe even if you have one boyfriend, and a dyke, again, if you won't sleep with them. And I asked all the soldiers I've interviewed if they agreed with that, and they all said yes.
Well, what are we to make of this? As you said, the military has set up a response system, a website, the Sexual Assault Prevention and Response System. They say that there's been an increase in the number of reported sexual assaults from 1,700 in 2004 to more than 2,300 a year later. They point to that as a sign that the program is working. But people might point to this and say, this is the reason why women should not be in the military.
Well, of course, rape happens in civilian life, too. And what are we supposed to do, remove the women from civilian life? It's an illogical argument. Not all men are doing this. Lots of the soldiers told me about being treated very well by their male comrades, who treat them as sisters just as they treat their comrades as brothers. And I've heard from all these soldiers that if their commanders did not tolerate the mistreatment of women, and that includes the pervasive harassment, the sexual demeaning, the verbal demeaning, it doesn't happen. That's where it to start the reforms, is in the attitude of those in command and who have superior position.
Given that, as you write, over 160,000 women have served in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Middle East since 2003, one of every seven soldiers is a woman, it would seem as if the military would have extra incentive to do something about this, given that, you know, what we understand about war is that the one thing that is important for soldiers or a unit to survive is comradeship.
This is the essence of what I find so heartbreaking about this subject. The one thing that keeps soldiers going and always has is the love of the fellow soldiers and the idea of watching each other's backs. And if that soldier who's supposed to watch your back and sacrifice his life for yours is assaulting you and is treating you like a prostitute and is treating you like an inferior person all the time, how could you trust him in battle? And it leaves women soldiers very often completely alone and isolated in this awful situation of war.
Well, and I would think it would be as dangerous for the male soldiers as well to create a situation where they have a comrade that doesn't trust them.
Yes, absolutely.
Helen Benedict is a journalism professor at Columbia University. She reported on sexual assault in the military for Salon.com and is working on a book on female veterans. Helen, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And Okay, well, still to come, that new HBO project in which addicts literally see their brains on drugs. You're listening to Here and Now. Okay, this week the big dance takes the floor as college basketball begins its search for a national champion. There are games today in the men's tournament, and don't worry, we're not going to give away any scores. And the women begin their games this weekend, so joining us to talk about the tournament and the rest of the news from the world of sports, one of our favorite dance partners.
Aww.
I know. Only a game host, Bill Littlefield. Bill, always lovely to see you.
Good to be here.
Well, you know, the tournament has barely begun, but our office productivity has already dropped, and I noticed your producer, Gabe, is down watching even as we speak.
Yes, of course. It's his job. You know, it's a dirty job, but somebody has to do it.
Right. The one person in our office who should be doing the grids is Emiko Tamagawa, who knows what she's talking about, but she's not. Everybody else is. We have no idea what we're talking about. And, by the way, it's for entertainment purposes only.
And nobody knows what they're talking about at this point, so don't worry about a thing.
But, you know, I see your grid right there. Who are the teams you're watching for in these early rounds?
Oh, it's fun in the early rounds to speculate about upsets. Wouldn't it be fun if Holy Cross on the women's side going into the tournament 15-17 were to knock off Duke? I mean, that'd be kind of fun. Duke's lost only once all season. On the men's side, you want my first round upset pick in my own personal brackets.
Sure, and again, we're not acknowledging anything.
No, this is not a game that's happening as we speak. I like Winthrop over Notre Dame tomorrow.
Winthrop?
Yes.
Small.
It's a high school north of Boston. I don't know how they're going to knock off Notre Dame, but they're going to do it.
Okay. Well, CBS is contributing to all of this because, as they did last year, they're going to be streaming games from the first three rounds live, people watching The Office. And in fact, CBS provides a way for fake spreadsheets to pop up to replace the game if your boss happens to walk by.
Mm-hmm.
This is big business for the network.
Sure. And I work in the only office where it's not necessary to employ this technology.
Right.
Because it's our work.
Which you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Well, the women begin their tournament this weekend. Among the teams ranked number one in their regions, a couple of regulars, Tennessee, Connecticut. The state of North Carolina claims the other two top rankings, with both Duke and University of North Carolina Chapel Hill getting top seeds. You've been following both teams' year. They've had great seasons.
They have had great seasons, the result of which is that last year's winner, Maryland, returning five starters this year, is not a number one seed.
Yeah. What happened?
I mean, well, they lost a couple of games, and these other teams played so brilliantly. Duke didn't lose until the very last part of the season. It's one of the things that makes this tournament such fun. It's we're a far cry from the old days where you could look at four teams and say, well, one of these four is going to be the champ.
Right. Well, the Louisiana State University women are seeded number three in their regional tournament, but we want to note their coach, Pokey Chapman, suddenly resigned last week. It's got to be a distraction for them.
Well, it's a distraction, of course, on two fronts. One, you lose the woman who has been such a successful coach and led this team to the Final Four twice over the past 4 or 5 years. And then the second thing, of course, is the nature of the distraction. The whole program is, somewhat in confusion about what the result of these revelations will be when they finally come.
It's suspected that there was inappropriate conduct involving a former player, but again, no one's talking, so we don't know.
For the record, I think it's important. Sylvia Fowles, the closest thing this program has to a superstar, has come out and said, hey, this is a great woman. She was like a mother to me. She's one of the greatest people I've ever known in my life. My opinion isn't going to change no matter what I later learn.
Quick look at other sports. Pete Rose, back in the headlines. He was on The Big Show with Dan Patrick and Keith Olbermann on ESPN Radio yesterday, talking about how he bet on the team he used to manage, the Cincinnati Reds. Let's just hear a little.
I bet on my team every night.
Okay.
Okay, I didn't bet on my team four nights a week. So I wasn't sending a single out to the team. I'm not going to use my closer on Friday night or Saturday night. And I was wrong. Okay,
but do you realize how strange this is? Now you're telling me more than we thought. In other words, our roles are reversed here.
Bill, I agree with Keith Olbermann. I mean, isn't this a guy, Pete Rose, who's trying to get into the Hall of Fame? What's going on?
Well, it's not really such a shock. I mean, Rose had acknowledged in a book a couple of years ago that he had bet on his team. Of course, previously had denied it and then admitted it and denied it again. This is simply a way to say, I bet on my team every night. I wasn't sending a signal by not betting some nights that I didn't expect the Reds to win. Of course, he hopes that this confession will lead eventually to baseball reinstating him.
Because he's been told he has to come clean.
That was the old Barciamatti line. Be repentant, come clean, and we may consider a reinstatement somewhere down the line.
Well, we heard the come clean part. Repentant. Bill Littlefield.
Not from Pete.
No. Bill Littlefield covers sports and a whole lot more every weekend on his NPR program, Only a Game. Be sure to check it out. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Tonight, HBO launches The Addiction Project, a multimedia series with the goal to help Americans understand addiction. Now, you might ask, what more is there to know? Well, after watching the real-life subjects at the center of the HBO project, you'll realize there's plenty left to learn.
There are misconceptions that really drive me crazy when it comes to addictions. One of them is this whole idea that an individual needs to reach rock bottom before they can get any help. And that is absolutely wrong.
I'm ashamed because I looked into the eyes of my children. And that wasn't enough to make me stop.
How can we comprehend the concept of a person that wants to stop doing something and they cannot, despite catastrophic consequences? We're not speaking of little consequences. These are catastrophic. And yet they cannot control their behavior.
The Addiction Project is being offered on multiple platforms, including podcasts, a website, a companion book, and a series of town meetings throughout the U.S. We're going to have information on how you can find these at our website, here-now.org. Susan Fromke and John Hoffman are co-producers of the project. They join us now from NPR in New York. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I have to admit, I was one of those who thought, well, how are they going to move us again with a topic that's been so covered? But then, you know, there are scenes like one I'd like you both to listen to with me. It's about the brain and addiction, which much of the series is. And this is Nora Volkow. She's a doctor who pioneered the use of brain imaging in understanding and treating addiction. She's speaking to a 43-year-old crystal methamphetamine addict at the Brookhaven National Laboratory in New York. John, first of all, can you tell us what we're seeing as he sees it as well, these brain images?
He is an active user at the time of this brain imaging study, and he is being shown in this scene the damage that has been done to his brain as a result of his chronic drug use.
You can actually see it. There's a redness that shows up in the imaging of a healthy brain and doesn't show up in his. Let's listen.
Look at your brain and see how that red basically has disappeared. All of this part here is gone. You can clearly see there's much less activity in your brain than in the brain of this person. So one of the concerns is, of course, that as people that take methamphetamine grow older and continue to take it, are they putting themselves at risk for neurological diseases?
That won't go away.
That won't go away, and that will create symptoms. So, I mean, when we were speaking, and I'm being candid with you because there's no point of not being it, if you continue to take methamphetamine, this will not recover.
That's from The Addiction Project, that clip, and all others we're going to talk about are courtesy of HBO. This man who started using methamphetamine in his early 30s, we see in this scene the remarkable possibility of recovering, as the doctor said. You can possibly repair this. But we also hear he then goes on to say, well, if I quit maybe a year from now, will my brain recover? What does he tell us about an addict?
That there's a lot of denial that comes along with this disease. And I think that he's a little skeptical, first of all, that this is his brain scan that they're showing. And he's very ambivalent about whether he wants to stop or not. And I think that's something that's very, very common with addiction.
The good news is that with abstinence, some of this drug use or alcohol use can be reversed, which is why treatment is essential. And many of the treatments that are talked about in your project include some of the newer drugs. Now, you wade into some controversial waters. Many of these medications, including topiramate, we've reported on. It's a drug that makes the claim that alcoholics can use this drug and be less likely to want a second drink. It's a pretty controversial topic. Many AA movement followers say that that's not possible, that even with medication, alcoholics shouldn't drink at all.
The clinical study that we are filming is showing that topiramate calms the system down so that it's really an anti-craving medication. It helps you be able to stabilize so that you can then hopefully make some progress with your behavioral therapy in terms of managing your addiction.
And it's hard. It's very, very hard because the motivation, as Nora Volkoff says in the beginning of the film, people are willing to do things despite catastrophic consequences. So you have to imagine that the brain has been so altered that the reasonable thinking that otherwise would go on is impaired. And so you need to really let the brain recover, and it takes a long time.
Let's listen to an older gentleman, a self-proclaimed alcoholic, who's tried topiramate.
But I think that medication made it so much easier for me. Well, for example, today I can pick and choose what I want to do. If I want to do something in the house, if I want to go out or go somewhere, I can do that. And days gone by, I know what I'd do. I'd be sitting here drinking in the middle of the day.
Well, then the bigger problem becomes, who will pay for this care and this treatment? We see heartbreaking testimony before the Pennsylvania legislature. Roberta Lojack was one of many parents who testified to try to urge legislators in Pennsylvania to enforce an act that would make insurance companies properly assess and provide for addiction treatment. Roberta Lojack's daughter was one who was prematurely released after only 7 days of drug treatment, even though I think the policy said she should get 28. And that release had tragic results. Let's listen.
She wasn't ready to come home. I know she wasn't. So went back home, and Ashley made us dinner, and she went to bed. The next morning, I looked in at about 8 o'clock, and I saw her laying there sleeping. TV was on. She still was holding her remote. And I looked at her fingernails were blue. So I started screaming. I ran out of the room. I called 911, went back in there. I picked her up and put her on the floor and tried to do CPR to my own daughter. She was already dead.
How is the insurance industry going to pay for this?
The alternative is to pay for much more serious health problems that will result from the ongoing use of drugs and, in particular, alcohol. It's estimated that the impact on our society is $500 billion a year. This is the cost to healthcare. This is the cost to lost employment, lost productivity. It is really, really a national crisis that has to be addressed.
We started by saying that after so much about addiction over the last 20 years, what could there be that's new? Tell us about the South Boston Drug Court.
Well, drug courts are an institution that began probably about 20 years ago when a number of judges who were really getting tired of seeing people cycling through their courts, and they said, you know what, we have to treat these people because clearly locking them up is not working. And so they decided that they could implement a whole shadow system of justice where people who were convicted of nonviolent felonies would participate in a very, very strict program of treatment. They're tested all the time. And if they make it through, then their record is wiped clean. And what this has shown very unexpectedly to the clinical community is that you can mandate treatment. You can force people into treatment, and it works. If the brain has the time to clear up, it is open to these very constructive messages of behavior change and therapy.
That's John Hoffman, along with Susan Fromke, co-producer of The Addiction Project. For more on all of it, the podcast, the companion book, town meetings, go to our website, here-now.org. Susan, John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The needle tears the hole. The old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away. But I remember everything.
The Late Johnny Cash. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
My sweetest friend, everyone I know goes away.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
My empire of dirt, I will let you down. I will make you.
PRI, Public Radio International.